Okay, everybody, good afternoon. Let's get started. I think we've got enough time for people getting here. I'm Sabina Dietrich, and co-director with Mike Blackhurst of the Urban Regional Analysis Program at UXER, and a faculty member here in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs here at GISPIA. So really happy to see everybody. I know at the end of the term, there's other things calling you, but glad that you could make it. And I'm really happy today to have Margaret Dewar, Margie, here from the University of Michigan, and Maura Engler, who's a graduate student and a Pittsburgh native. Maura was a graduate of Tulane and worked in various jobs here in Pittsburgh, I think including a recent stint at the Urban Redevelopment Authority. So it's good to have her back in town, although Kathy Buchel, my colleague's not, her mother's not here. But Margie and I used to do some research together on brownfields, and next week the EPA Brownfields Conference is back in Pittsburgh for its anniversary trip. And we did a lot on community impacts and community redevelopment and how CDCs and other community organizations worked around brownfields. So it was a real pleasure to do academic work with Margie, plus all the incredible work that she's done over her career in economic development, housing, community development, and especially urban revitalization in what are sometimes called shrinking cities and legacy cities. We think of them as old post-industrial cities, but Margie's never met a place like Detroit or Cleveland that she didn't think about doing some kind of research in and spending some time. Margie, welcome back to University of Pittsburgh, and it's a pleasure to have you. I think everybody can see what we're going to be doing, what she's going to be talking about today, so turning, we'll go getting to green with you.
Okay. Thanks. Great. Thanks, Sabina. It's good to be here, and actually good to have an audience when you are you in exams, or are you about to go into exams? You know what it's like. So, Sabina's right. I've never met a shrinking city I didn't love, actually. And I think that urban planning has a great opportunity in planning for shrinking cities. The urban planning usually focuses on growth and on development. And we know how to manage, incentivize, control, whatever, development and growth, or development at least. And however, a lot of cities aren't having that much development. They are instead having increasing amounts of vacant land and disinvested structures. So how do planners work in such settings? So I decided some years ago that this is what I wanted to work on. How do I get urban planning moved over towards dealing with shrinking cities? And I've actually had some planners say to me, "We don't do that. We don't work in places like that." And in part that's true because those cities are also fiscally hard up, so they don't have the money, and their planning departments are often the first to go when they cut. But anyway, some cities in the last 10, 15 years have actually developed plans that accept that the cities are going to be smaller and work on how to make them better, smaller places. Youngstown 2010 plan won a national award for its vision of Youngstown as a smaller, better place. Detroit Future City, oh, and also it has been adopted in the city. And then Detroit Future City was a strategic framework plan for Detroit's vacant, and well, for Detroit as a whole. How would it adapt to its loss of huge percent of its population, 62% of its population since its peak? It was funded by foundations. It has not been adopted by the city council or the mayor. Reimagining a More Sustainable Cleveland did similar things for Cleveland and was adopted by the city council in 2008. Imagine Flint, a master plan for sustainable Flint, has been adopted as the master plan for Flint. So these plans envision massive shifts in land use. In the left, these are from Detroit Future City, the plan for Detroit. On the left, the yellow, is residential property. A lot of it obsolete residential property, a lot of vacant land, a lot of structures that need to come down. On the right is the vision for 50 years from then, or really 50 years from now, And you can see a lot of blue and green. The darker blue is was envisioned as innovation productive. So solar panels and forests and tree, Christmas tree farms and things like that. Urban agriculture as well. The more turquoise blue was envisioned as innovation ecological, meaning lots of stormwater treatment, constructed marshlands, things like that. And the green is green residential, the lighter green. The darker green is parks that exist already. The lighter green is green residential, which really means occasional houses with a great deal of vacant land around them. So as a planner, I know that land use transition isn't necessarily so easy. We usually think of it as moving towards the highest and best use. So what kind of transition happens when the highest and best use may well be a dumped on vacant lot? You don't have profits to be made, probably, from most of these new uses. So I thought, because this is so vital to creating a more pleasant place to live, a better quality of life in these cities, I wanted to find out how this could happen. And therefore, thought I'd choose the easiest kind of transition, I thought easiest, to examine. You have a derelict structure in this corner, the top left corner. It's demolished. You have a basement that's already a hole that you can then fill and grade in ways that accommodate stormwater, and then plant it and landscape it in a way that enhances the neighborhood. So I thought, okay, if we study this, we'll learn about what goes on with governance in these situations, because governance is going to probably be key, given that profit doesn't drive anyone to try to make this change. And by governance, I mean the laws, the regulations, codes, bureaucratic practices, and political and social relationships that between government and other entities that can implement policy. So I'm going to talk about our first investigation, which was of Cleveland and Detroit, and then Moira is going to talk about looking at other legacy cities. I'm calling them legacy as opposed to shrinking, because that's the more politically acceptable term among legacy cities. Mayors don't like to be called shrinking cities. So Mara's then going to talk about what we've discovered about other shrinking cities, legacy cities, that are trying to implement green infrastructure. So first I'll explain what green infrastructure is, just in case some people don't know. Wouldn't assume everybody does. On the right is a visualization of a green infrastructure installation. Actually, it doesn't show the sewer, the catch basin on the street that's been redirected towards this area, which receives the water and is then planted with plants that can absorb the water, but also underneath it has quite a bit of different kind of medium to hold water. If the water gets too deep, there's a drain pipe that will then take the water to the sewer, which would have been where all of it went in the past. So it delays the movement to the sewer. It also means a lot of it doesn't ever get to the sewer. In contrast, what it's dealing with is this other picture, which is the gray infrastructure, the current situation for lots of these cities which have combined sewer systems, meaning storm and sewage and household and industrial water go into the same system. And when it's not raining too hard, that water then comes into the drains, goes into the sewage to the treatment plant. I don't know if you can see this, and I don't have a pointer, but this way to a treatment plant. So that's fine. But when there's a storm of any significance, and sometimes not that much significance, there's the water comes down, gets this dam, which is not high enough to keep some of it from overflowing and going into the Lake Erie in Cleveland's case, or the Detroit River, or whatever, raw sewage and untreated stormwater runoff. So that's what green infrastructure is supposed to alleviate some of, at least. As I said, we looked at Detroit and Cleveland. The reason for looking at those two cities was that they both have very weak demand for property. They have similar, they have a lot, both have a lot of vacant land that needs to be reused in different ways to meet their plan's visions. And Detroit's slightly weaker demand. Detroit has lost 62% of its population from the peak. Cleveland's lost 57%. Detroit has lost 34% or so of its housing units, and Cleveland has lost about 25%. They have similar poverty rates. In fact, they kind of trade places year to year on which one has the highest poverty rate for a big city in the United States. So usually it's between 34% and 40% of the population. So similar demand. They also have similar requirements they're facing to deal with the combined sewer overflows that I showed you. Both have old sewer systems and so frequently have combined sewer overflows. The Environmental Protection Agency has required both to reduce these combined sewage overflows drastically. And EPA does this in several ways. In the Detroit case, it's what's called a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, which says that the Water and Sewage District has to spend, and notice it's spend, not reduce CSOs, spend $50 million over 20 years for green infrastructure. They've been allowed to do this because, rather than use gray infrastructure, because the gray infrastructure investment would be so huge that it would put a huge additional burden on ratepayers who are so many of whom are in poverty. In Cleveland, a consent decree requires the sewage district to capture 44 million gallons of water of what would be combined sewage overflow. So they have actually the CSO requirement part. So they're similar in that way, which is good for the research design, but they differ in key ways. Because of a higher, not having the pressure of real estate profits, government actions and nonprofits actions are especially important in making green infrastructure happen. In Detroit, government officials in city and county tend not to work together well. And across departments, they have a reputation for not collaborating as much as they might. In Cleveland, the opposite story is told. In many instances, county and city work together, and in Cleveland, the departments regularly talk with each other. Now, one person told me, yeah, we talk. We don't necessarily get it done. But anyway, the two have these different reputations that are at least partially justified. In addition, Cleveland has perhaps the strongest community development industry in the nation. They have a long tradition of supporting their community development organizations. These are the ones who would want to use green infrastructure to enhance neighborhoods. And so they would be looking for ways to do that. In Detroit, the community development industry's never been nearly as strong as Cleveland's and was decimated by the recession. So even though nonprofits in Detroit may want to do this, they have much less capacity. So therefore, we expected Cleveland to show us ways that innovations could happen in governance that would make the installation of GI work, and therefore provide some suggestions for the Detroit people about what they could do. In Detroit, we looked at two different kinds of installations. One was one that I've been involved in and we'll say a little bit more about as we go along, called New GI, where we worked with the Water and Sewerage Department and the Land Bank to install green infrastructure on some sites that were being demolished and then transforming them into green infrastructure. And then another project was going on at the same time on the east side of the city called funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And so they were also doing it. We thought in this case the stories would be similar about what we and they went through in getting the projects installed. So what did we find? Everyone likes green water, stormwater infrastructure. People really in neighborhoods would really like this to happen. We didn't find political opposition or vocal opposition of any type, which is unusual for projects in cities. And the projects that I just mentioned were implemented, so they happened, and that's an accomplishment. But doing the implementation was very difficult. Cleveland confirmed the challenges in Detroit, did not show innovative ways to overcome governance challenges. So it was more a confirming case rather than a contrasting case. And the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative projects confirmed the issues that we'd faced on our new GI projects. But what made it possible? These happened after all. Well, the federal requirements didn't leave a choice, which was very important, that EPA, overcoming those EPA requirements would be expensive and time-consuming and involve a lot of legal efforts, and so they weren't doing that, trying to challenge those. And the barriers were addressed through personal relationships. So in our case, the head of the Land Bank Authority would call the head of the interim head of the Water and Sewerage Department, and they would work it out, something that wasn't where we had run into a roadblock. There was commitment from the leaders of certain departments, key departments, in both cities. Though in Cleveland, there was a lot of doubt that on the part of the sewage department people that they could actually meet the requirement with green infrastructure. And so that contrast between in Detroit, a requirement to spend the money on green infrastructure versus in Cleveland, the requirement to actually reduce CSOs with green infrastructure. They said, we know how to do it. In Cleveland, they said, we know how to do this with gray infrastructure. We have to just do it with gray. But they were doing green, too. So, but then, it was extremely difficult, as I said. And why? In both cities, the department people really wanted to make it work, but whole city's organizations were set up for traditional gray infrastructure, sewers and catch basins and treatment plants and big storage tanks. But for green infrastructure, it wasn't clear who was responsible for any parts of the work in different departments. And you can see the list of the departments that had to be involved for our projects and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative projects. So there were no routines. There were no systems. And especially for installing green infrastructure on vacant land, which is what those plans I showed you at the beginning had envisioned. Now, as both cities are working on these things, so this, I expect that more and more will be resolved as time goes on, and that will be really interesting to see how that happens. Besides the issue that the departments weren't used to working together and didn't know what their roles were, There were no regulation permitting or inspections protocols. A consultant working on our projects took in the drawings, and people from numerous departments were there, and he said, well, who's supposed to inspect? And they all essentially said, not I. I do it on private land. This is land bank land, public land. Or I do it on the gray infrastructure sewer systems. I don't do it on green. And so it was very much, and in the end, we got no permits. There was no regulation, and there were no inspections. But you can imagine that wouldn't be desirable. We had to have cement installed. We had to redirect the sewers. In the future, I really think these should be inspected and permitted. So for us, it helped that they didn't want to, but that isn't necessarily good. And for someone else, it would be seen as a barrier. How do I even get through here? Overcoming these barriers would be facilitated, presumably, if the mayors made this a major part of their agendas. But the mayors have not done that, quite understandably. Frank Jackson in Cleveland is needing to lead recovery from a huge number of mortgage foreclosures and losses of millions of dollars of city revenues as property values plunged. He has prioritized the reform of the police department, understandably too, which is under a Department of Justice consent decree. He is committed to improving city services, especially in the building and housing department, lead abatement, and he wants to create a violence prevention program. Those are really important. In Detroit, the mayor on the right, Mayor Duggan, needed to emerge from bankruptcy, and he needed to restore basic city services. Pretty much no services were being provided by the time the city went into bankruptcy. And he also pledged to demolish tens of thousands of structures that needed demolition and had for quite a while, and increase jobs and improve affordable housing. They actually sound more important to me than dealing with green infrastructure for combined sewage overflow. So why would a mayor ever do this? In cities where it has happened, and Moira will talk more about this, they lay it out as this will create jobs, Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia says. And indeed it will some, but it's not known yet how many and what kind. And they could make an argument, though, that this will, on the installation of green infrastructure on vacant land, will improve quality of life in neighborhoods, improve property values ultimately, and improve city revenues ultimately, and make more people want to live there. But the way that the green infrastructure is being implemented is not consistent with that kind of argument. The almost exclusive policy attention is on managing stormwater where new construction and redevelopment are occurring. So even though there's very little development happening in these cities except in very small areas, and there's loads of vacant land that might be repurposed that does not now hold much stormwater but could. The Cleveland on your right, there was a building of a hotel in Cleveland Circle where the sewage department gave them an extra parcel of land if they would use green infrastructure in their parking lot, and they did. And in Detroit, there's now a requirement you have to manage your stormwater on site if you do redevelopment. But that's not where the land use transition envisioned by planners would be happening. So it hasn't yet advanced that kind of change. In addition, the long-term plans that the city's developed in response to the EPA requirement designate gigantic areas of the cities for as priority for green infrastructure. In the case of Detroit on the left, that's between 20% and 25% of the city's area. And on the right, you can see all of Cleveland is shown, so you can see that a great deal of Cleveland's area is in green. But that is not sufficient sufficiently precise if you are needing to figure out how, for instance, if foundations are interested in giving, say, $300,000 to a nonprofit, one of the key actors, as I said, in doing this kind of thing. But the nonprofit can't figure out, well, where would it actually advance the reduction of CSOs? Where would it, where will the city allow long-term easements and things like that that then preserve the green infrastructure over time? So they end up putting it where it will make the neighborhood nicer primarily because they don't know where else, except within that huge orange area, and that it will actually affect anything. So that's a lost opportunity. The underemphasis on green infrastructure to strengthen neighborhoods where there's huge enthusiasm about getting green infrastructure to make our vacant lots look better, that hasn't been capitalized on in either providing the information about where to place it or emphasizing changes in the way permitting and so forth work for projects that don't involve new development. In both Cleveland and Detroit, this has been the case. In addition, installing green infrastructure is one thing, but keeping it going and functioning is another. And long-term maintenance responsibilities haven't been resolved at all. The on the left is a project planted in Cleveland, but almost all the plants have died, and so no one has replanted or done something to keep them alive. I don't know what they didn't do, but I have visited this site a couple times, and it was planted in the past, and it was still alive. And then on your right, that's a tree planting site that has dumping, and neighbors complain that the trees are planted in such a way that they can't get riding lawnmowers through to make the property look somewhat neat. So they find it a detriment to the neighborhood rather than an asset because of the maintenance issues. So these findings point to substantial barriers in governance that these cities need to still overcome. And so the next question we had was, okay, how do we ever, well, first of all, how will this kind of land use transition envisioned by the planners ever occur? And we decided to look at other cities to find out if other legacy cities to find out if they had managed to do so more successfully, or really not even more successfully, just resolved a little bit of something of the numerous barriers we'd found. And so Moira is going to talk about what we looked at with respect to that question.
Margie. So I'm going to talk about some research that myself and two of my other colleagues, Grace Cho and Rebecca LaBove, have done over the past year and a half. Builds off of the research that Margie just mentioned in Cleveland and Detroit. But these are the cities that we looked at. We first chose them because these were cities that kept coming up as being leaders kind of in the green infrastructure field. Additionally, all of them had lost at least 20% of their peak population by 2010, the last decennial census, and all have significant amounts of vacant publicly owned land. Some have experienced a lot more reinvestment than others, like Philadelphia and Washington, but overall, these are the cities we chose to look at. So my talk is going to talk about three different sections of our research. The first will be how city governments have changed structures to better accommodate green infrastructure. The second will be how to encourage residents, business owners, and nonprofits to install green infrastructure. And then finally, maintenance and long-term land control of green infrastructure projects. So the first kind of section that we looked at was changing city government to strengthen systems for installing green infrastructure. And these are some of the strategies that we found cities were using to kind of further this process. So the first was leadership from mayors and city and county sewer officials. As Margie mentioned, leadership can be really important in furthering green infrastructure because it can encourage focus and collaboration across departments to make GI or green infrastructure happen on a larger scale. Second is the reorganization of water and sewer departments. Implementing green infrastructure requires adjustments in the organization and process of water and sewer departments to facilitate new ways of working. And similarly, interdepartmental coordination is kind of very key in implementing these projects. And so fostering collaboration across departments really ensures that these things will get done. Then we looked at revisions to codes and ordinances. So most city zoning codes are not written with stormwater management in mind, let alone green infrastructure. So many of them actually have provisions that make installing green infrastructure more difficult, like, you know, demolition standards, not grading, you know, grading lots towards the street so that the water goes directly into the storm drain instead of managing water on site. So kind of keeping green infrastructure in mind and putting it into the code is another way to further this process. And then we looked at, similarly, again, systems for site plan approval. So a lot of, some cities have changed their ordinances to require stormwater management plans that certain developments manage the water on site. A plan for the location of green infrastructure. A lot of cities have kind of strategically thought about what neighborhoods or parts of the city would be most successful for managing stormwater. Use of information systems. So interdepartmental coordination depends on data sharing, and using GIS and other information systems to do this is a good way to foster collaboration. And then finally, engagement and education programs with businesses, owners, and nonprofits. Large-scale green infrastructure kind of depends on the buy-in from these groups. So cities need to engage with these groups on the importance of stormwater management as well as kind of reacting to failed projects. So I'm going to focus in this part on reorganization of water and sewer departments and interdepartmental coordination using an example from Philadelphia. So in 2011, Philadelphia created the Green City Clean Waters Plan as a response to the EPA requirements that they were under. This was basically a plan that was going to reduce their CSOs and improve water quality. It's a shift away from traditional stormwater management projects. And the as a result, the commissioner of the water department at the time decided to reorganize the department so that to focus on green infrastructure, and so all green infrastructure activities could be kind of housed under one roof. So to do this, he created two different divisions. So the Office of Watersheds, which monitors compliance with the city's long-term control plan and EPA requirements, and then the Green Infrastructure Division, which identifies projects, coordinates construction and design, kind of collaborates with outside partners. This has four different subunits, which are planning, design, stormwater plan review, and incentives. So as a result of this reorganization, there has been a lot more interdepartmental coordination in Philadelphia. The way that they make this happen is through these memoranda of understanding, or MOUs. These MOUs are used to coordinate work between city departments and kind of organize the process into a partnership model that facilitates future joint projects. So as of 2017, MOUs exist between the Water Department and the Streets Department, SEPTA, which is the Transit Authority, the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority, and then the Philadelphia Land Bank. The Water Department is also pursuing MOUs with the Parks and Recreation Department. So there's still uncertainties about whether or not this can really foster a long-term collaboration or if it's just kind of an intermediate step to a larger strategy. So the second part of our research looked at encouraging how cities have encouraged businesses, residents, and nonprofits to install green infrastructure. So the first strategy was incentives. Some cities have sort of tried to implement incentives for people to get them to install green infrastructure on their own property. This includes direct grants, so just giving them the money to do it directly, or creating kind of stormwater credits that go towards a city stormwater drainage fee for installing green infrastructure. You would get credits that reduce your fee. Off-site ways to meet these requirements or reduce fees, especially on vacant land. In some cities, development projects that trigger requirements to manage stormwater on-site can meet them off-site, potentially by directing stormwater to vacant properties or by paying for green infrastructure to be installed somewhere else in the city. Use of information systems. These can help those outside government learn how to reduce their water and sewer fees and what kinds of green infrastructure projects can help them do this. And resources and services. Some cities have produced materials that have design guidelines or other information that help these groups know how to install green infrastructure, what types make sense for what types of land, and how to make it look good. So I'm going to focus on this section with on partnerships and initiatives with nonprofit organizations that have strengthened GI installation on vacant land. So this is a project of the Cleveland Botanical Garden. It's called Vacant to Vibrant. It actually operates across three of the cities that we've researched, so Cleveland, Buffalo, and Gary, Indiana. The Cleveland Botanical Garden received a grant from the Great Lakes Protection Fund to install green infrastructure on vacant land in these three cities. In Buffalo, the nonprofit organization People United for Sustainable Housing, or PUSH, partnered with the Botanical Garden to implement green infrastructure on lots in Buffalo. The Botanical Garden provided technical assistance for the installation of the projects, while PUSH provided community outreach as well as the land to install these projects. There were 9 completed sites as part of this program. And then in Gary, Vacant to Vibrant partnered with Gary's local government to install green infrastructure on publicly owned land. There were 15 demonstration projects done as part of this program. So as Margie mentioned, cities still struggle a lot with how to kind of maintain these projects long term. So this is kind of one of the biggest challenges of these projects is long term maintenance. Maintenance of green infrastructure is very unique. It's not kind of a typical skill set that water and sewer public works departments have in-house. They also don't typically have the funding to allocate for this kind of maintenance. And then as a result, oftentimes kind of resident-driven maintenance plans are suggested. But residents of the neighborhoods that are most likely to have high vacancy where these projects would be implemented don't have the time or money or resources to actually do the maintenance. So maintenance plans need to be well thought out and created before the installation of the project occurs. Neglect happens frequently, and when it does, it really kind of undermines the ability of the project to accomplish its goals of retaining stormwater. So the picture of Baltimore that you see, that's from a project that they did called the Baltimore Growing Green Initiative. It was a project of the mayor's office, the former mayor. It awarded grants to 6 green infrastructure projects on vacant lots throughout the city. It's a great model for a program to incentivize community organizations and residents to install green infrastructure. However, of the 6 projects that were completed in 2015, only a handful or very few of them are actually still maintained today. So this photo shows one of the competition winners. I took this in October. This is the Bridgeview Green Lawn Community Enhancement Project. It's no longer maintained, and it's been fenced off from the public. And then the other picture is a project in Philadelphia that, again, just hasn't really been maintained and is kind of a major source of complaints for the neighborhood. So, again, Philly has taken some steps to attempt to address this problem. First off, their just public maintenance policy. Basically, they work, the water department signs agreements with the Department of Public Property to kind of maintain their lots, to maintain their projects. And the Parks and Recreation Department has an agreement to maintain green infrastructure projects in the parks. Then the Soak It Up program is a collaboration between the Pennsylvania Environmental Council and the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation that provides grants to civic organizations to maintain green infrastructure sites. And then finally, Land Care is a program of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society that works with 18 community organizations to provide landscaping treatments to over 12,000 parcels. 1/4 of those are publicly owned. And then finally, long-term land control is another major challenge of these cities. Legacy cities are often reluctant to commit to not developing parts of the city that have been vacant for a long time. They're reluctant to set aside low-demand vacant land for use as permanent green space. It's hard to clearly identify which parts of the city should be set aside for no future development and what criteria to base these decisions on. So in order for long-term use of vacant land as green infrastructure, cities should identify areas that are not to be developed and construct green infrastructure in these areas. So this image is from Buffalo's long-term land use plan from 2016. The image on your left shows the vacant parcels in the city of Buffalo, and then the image on your right is the long-term land use plan. So you can see the green sections on that map are land that's being preserved or set aside as permanent green space or open space. So as you can see, the vacancy areas and the areas set aside for green don't really match up. This means that any kind of projects that are implemented on vacant lots in Buffalo in these areas have a very uncertain future. It's not clear how long they'll be there, and it's kind of difficult to justify investing in them. And then, so one place that's kind of attempted to address this is New Orleans. Their redevelopment authority runs a program called Growing Green. This provides long-term leases to businesses, nonprofits, residents that want to do green projects. So they define that as urban agriculture, green infrastructure, or community gardens. The people who want to execute these projects are able to do so for $250 per year per lot, with an option to purchase the lot after 3 years of successful project implementation. As part of the purchase agreement, there's a clause that requires them to maintain the use of that lot as the green use. Otherwise, NORA can claw back that property. So as of this year, 35 lots have been leased and 22 lots have been purchased through this program. Some downsides, though, are that $250 per year per lot is pretty expensive. And also, it's unclear out of the lots that they have leased or sold, how many of these are actually used for green infrastructure. So with that, Margie will conclude our presentation.
So what we found in sum is that the transition from a derelict residential property to positive use in the form of green stormwater infrastructure is extremely difficult and likely to be a very long-term project. So 2050 might be the right year to be looking at it. And that It's not just land use change. The land use change means transformation of the way city government does its work and the way it interacts with others in doing their work, which means getting to the sustainable city versus the sanitary city is a much more profound transformation than the land use planners had envisioned. Now we see progress and lots of changes, and so we're optimistic on that front. It's just a lot of hard work and not the easy transition that I thought it might be at all. So I want to say the project that we're part of is involves a lot of other people as well, the Water and Sewage Department and the Land Bank Authority, to community-based organizations in the Warrendale section of Detroit. And then a professor and her students in landscape architecture, another in public health, another in sociology, and a person in civil and environmental engineering at Wayne State University. And we received funding from the University of Michigan Water Center and from the Herb Foundation, a foundation dedicated to seeing more sustainable practices such as green infrastructure. Questions? Comments?
Thanks, Margie. Let's open it up for questions from all of you. Well, I'll get started then. Margie, you started out on your slide when you changed over to looking at different places, and the number one on the list was leadership. And Margie had ended with talking about Detroit and Cleveland with mayors who were very preoccupied with some other more pressing problems. Do you want to talk about Philadelphia and Michael Nutter's role? This became a very important part of his period and,
yeah.
and how it came about, and say something about Michael Nutter and his role in Philadelphia, Margie. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, he's the preeminent example in the nation of a mayor who did say this was the priority, a major priority. And then in various speech, and he said that within weeks of his inauguration. And in other speeches he's given, he's indicated why. He said, Philadelphia needs more jobs for people who don't have a lot of education and skills. The maintenance of green infrastructure promises that. We don't actually know that it does. There's been not enough experience to know that that would be the case, but it was certainly a motivation for him. Second, he thanked the EPA for allowing them to use green infrastructure instead of gray. And they are using they are proposing to use green infrastructure exclusively to solve their CSO problems. So it is not the modest levels of other cities. This is major. And many people wonder whether they can actually do that, but so far they're continuing. So he thanked the EPA for allowing that because gray infrastructure would put such a burden on an already fiscally stressed city with a lot of people who couldn't pay higher rates. And so this was a relief, a financial relief for the city. In another case, Buffalo, the map that Moira showed, the one on the right, is from the new Green Code. And it, also called the Land Use Plan, but anyway, it's the mayor there has very strongly endorsed green infrastructure and green approaches in general, but he constantly talks only about this is the way to get more development in Buffalo. So it's not nearly the extent of commitment that Nutter has. And Nutter's no longer the mayor, but the new mayor is still on track with this. Other question? Yes?
Can you say a little bit more about why Cleveland was given the consent decree and then Detroit was given this green infrastructure study mandate by the EPA?
It related to the past. I can't remember enough to tell you everything, but which way they do it depends on past compliance or lack of compliance on the scale of the problem and whether they've made any progress under other approaches. So Cleveland had permits before they got sued and had to have a consent decree. So it's and Detroit went through numerous permits where they didn't meet what they said they would at all. But because of the extreme financial hardship of the city, it went towards another permit instead of a lawsuit. Lots of threats of lawsuits. So I don't really know how, it's the same EPA division over both, but I've never asked them that. Yes.
In any of these cities where there were large areas where properties were abandoned, did the cities ever consider vacating streets and eliminating streets to reduce stormwater runoff?
Not that I know of. In Detroit, I have suggested that many times in various, actually, through classes that looked at it. But they seem to be, on an every 25-year, replace the street, whether or not it's used or not, and whether or not it needs it. But it's just sort of another thing they need to. I think this new mayor will be working on that, try to reduce costs rather than reduce stormwater runoff. His issue would be cost. Yeah, streets are huge in providing CSOs. Others? Yes?
I found it sort of striking that projects that you sort of talked about after they had been implemented, for the most part, failed unless they were owned or there was an agreement on the part of the city to maintain that. Would you say that the most likely path to create infrastructure is that someone or the city has an agreement to maintain the property, or do you see a way forward to non-city maintenance?
Well, in Detroit, on the projects we've been involved in, I've argued this is your infrastructure. You maintain gray, you need to learn to maintain green, water and sewage department. They say, we only have so much money, we have to get other people to do it. And yeah, they're right, but other people aren't going to be able to. And so there has to be a lot more progress. On the ones we did, were involved with, there's a 3-year commitment for the water and sewage department to maintain it. I think we're about halfway through that now, or maybe 1 year through it. So that it has to come up soon.
Yeah, it seems like it has to be a combination of the city taking responsibility, and also I think the program in Philadelphia, the land care program, is often used as a pretty good example of how to kind of, you know, incentivize residents or provide some kind of job training to maintain the site. So I think, you know, there has to be a combination of the two measures.
Yes?
Could you talk a little bit about how the jurisdictional composition of an area influences this kind of transition? Like, I know in Philly, like, the city and county are consolidated, so there's, I would think, more streamlined kind of institutional structures there as opposed to, I'm not as familiar with some of the places like Detroit and Buffalo, but in Cleveland, you know, the sewer district encompasses, I don't know, scores of municipalities, including one of which is the city and the various institutions there. Could you guys just talk about that a little bit?
Yes, in Cleveland, the sewage district, I think, this lawsuit's been resolved. The suburban communities sued to not have the stormwater fee because they weren't having the CSOs, and so never mind that it was going downhill into the CSO areas. I believe I saw that it was in favor of the sewage district and then was on appeal, and I can't remember whether it's actually been decided, but it looked likely to be decided that it was okay. In Detroit, there's been no movement on that kind of issue because the bankruptcy resulted in the separation of the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department and the Great Lakes Water Authority. And they haven't seen, they so far, now they're still figuring out how they do things, but water falls in Oakland County, north of the city, and flows down through into the city and goes and contributes to the combined sewage overflows and to flooding. And no matter how much the city stores water, it may not, it's going to need to have some kind of resolution in Oakland County as well. Oakland County and the city of Detroit don't work together well. You may have seen a year or so ago the executive of Oakland County making a lot of racist, denigrating remarks about how people in the city were causing their own problems, and it sure wasn't his, and you know. So it'll take a while to change. But good question. The water doesn't observe the jurisdictional boundaries at all.
You mentioned when you talked about the restructuring of the Philadelphia Water Department that the Green Infrastructure Division offered incentives, and one of which was mentioned for the credit for stormwater drainage. Are there other cities that have these incentives built in? And in Philadelphia, have these incentives increased the number of projects that need green infrastructure?
So there are definitely other cities that offer like incentives that are credit-based. So Baltimore is another example of a city that has a stormwater fee. They offer credits kind of based on the capacity of the implemented green infrastructure that you do, or based on the amount of impervious surface that you reduce. In Philadelphia, I know they have a pretty good way of kind of explaining to people how the credits work. They have an online system where it's a map that you basically test out the size of your project, and it tells you exactly how much your fee will be reduced. So it seems relatively user-friendly. I don't know for sure if it's really had that much of an impact on how many of these projects are implemented. I do know that in Baltimore, I spoke with their public works department, which oversees their water and sewer stuff, and they said that basically not a lot of people do take advantage of the credit because these projects are pretty costly to implement themselves, and so the return on the investment is not quite there. So I think a lot of these places are finding that same thing, and so I think the real challenge is how to reduce or kind of offset some of the costs of installation up front.
So it's less of an issue of just straight up education and people knowing about these incentives, but more on the cost of side.
Exactly. Yeah. And Philadelphia has a program that called, I can't remember, GSARP or something like that, where it's they actually will provide something like $90,000 per greened acre. If you install, by that greened acre means an acre that all of whose water goes to the facility, and $90,000—that's a lot. But the engineers working on it in Detroit said that's how much it costs. And to really manage the water adequately, as opposed to having a pond. So, but even so, they haven't had that many takers yet. But I think hasn't been time to tell. Yes.
What are, for some of the small projects, you had some pictures of small projects, especially around the street or coming around a curb and pulling things out and some green pieces in there. There's some that have been done here, and I'm always wondering who's going to be be able to maintain it. And these are in pretty run areas with lots and lots of vacancy. And that group that came out as the volunteer group initially, who did such a great job, 3 or 4 years down the road, I'm wondering what kind of sustainability do some of these small scale volunteer projects have?
That's exactly the issue. Yeah.
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 Do you think you'd come up with any of the other cities, any other plans that might work, or? Organize at a city level, probably, right?
Yeah, I think, as Margie was saying earlier, I think that cities really need, you know, if they want to be serious about doing this, I think they have to also be serious about funding it, and particularly the maintenance of it. And so, you know, I just don't necessarily, I mean, this is just my opinion, I don't necessarily see these being a long-term solution unless cities get serious about putting funds towards it. You know, it would be nice if there were, you know, more kind of resident or volunteer-driven maintenance programs, and more of those that exist, the better. But, you know, I think for this stuff to make an impact, the city has to pay for it, basically.
And they are also hoping for philanthropic help.
Oh, this was my next question.
Yeah. And I think they'll get that. But, you know, foundations like to change what they're doing. They don't want to fund things long-term. They would fund the startups, I think.
Well, that was my next question, the follow-up. Maura's mother, Kathy Buchel, had Rip Raff sit in from Kresge. Skillman Foundation. And
yes.
I'm wondering if Kresge and Skillman have played any role in this, or would once foundation is in, given that foundation's leadership changes and focus changes, what the chances are for something like that?
It hasn't been Skillman's focus. That's been different. Kresge has funded some. Actually, a proposed project that my students came up with in a class with a community-based organization, they have now funded. So it'll happen. But and Herb Foundation is really the major one that's the source right now. But and then there's one called the Environmental Sustainability Fund or something, I can't remember. But, oh, and EPA has funded some, but yeah, it's not plentiful money. Yes?
So I kind of have a response to your question. I'm an intern at an organization called GTEC in Pittsburgh. I don't know if you are familiar, but we are actually piloting a program based on long-term maintenance of vacant lots and different projects that GTEC and other organizations have done. So we have like recruited community members in Homewood to maintain vacant lots or other programs, and we're doing an incentive-based credit system, so however many hours they put in, we are providing different incentives to kind of offset the barriers that these individuals in Homewood might face doing typical volunteer work. So just a
good
program that is in process.
Where's the money coming from?
We were funded by the Mentor Foundation.
Yeah, as Moira said, in a lot of these neighborhoods, people have two jobs, they're still in poverty, they have kids, they're extremely overcommitted, and so they need that kind of incentive of some type. Yeah.
Any other questions? Paul, do you want to talk about Newcastle?
Well,
yeah.
I'm a city councilman in Newcastle, which is 50 miles north. And we are a shrinking post-industrial city. We've lost half our population in the last 50 years, that kind of thing. And we had a situation, it's been like a six-year process of people would have storm water. When there was a storm, they would have water. Not just like come in their basement, like people say, I have water in my basement, but they would totally flood. And every other year you would flood, and there were different neighborhoods at different times. And so our gray infrastructure is like chalk. And I don't know why, and it's probably been, before I was born, it wasn't maintained and all those things. But we looked at a couple things in the last year, and what we're going to do is we're turning over our storm basins to our catch basins and our storm source to our sanitation authority, because we had a leaching situation. And there was times where there was wastewater coming out of manholes just at any time on the street. And instead of us fixing it through the general fund, because we could have never raised the millage we needed, we could do it through fees. And it's $6 a month for a home on top of their sanitation bill. But all the nonprofits in town can be charged the fee that we can never get to with millage. And I think it's going to work because there's a lot of money that's going to come in that we could have never used out of general fund. We're not going to have to float a bond or anything. But part of how it was drawn up does involve using the green infrastructure, but nobody was quite sure how they're going to maintain it as well. And there is no plan, but that's what I'm hoping I pick up a little bit here. But we're kind of trying to do the gray for necessity, but the green on top of it.
To take the pressure off.
One thing that's kind of interesting that Baltimore has done, and I think Detroit's thinking about doing, is this participation credit. It's not a huge amount of money, but basically you can receive credits towards your stormwater fee for either organizing or participating in like volunteer cleanup events. So that's kind of one way that could be a low-cost kind of way to reduce your stormwater fee. So,
and several, on the plan issue, a couple cities, Philadelphia and Gary, have extremely detailed analysis of every parcel, what its potential is for green infrastructure. And those have been helpful in figuring out where to put it and to for everyone. In Philadelphia, it's not public information, but in people in the public can't access it and use it. But in Gary, it's publicly accessible, and so anyone can say, "Aha, these lots on our street are high potential, and let's try to do something."
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, and best wishes with end of the semester.
Thank you, Marty and Laura.